Williams versus City of Champaign and others. Ms. Wyman.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ruth Wyman. I represent the plaintiffs, Deborah and Herman Williams, individually and on behalf of their minor son, Rashad. This case is here on appeal from the district court's grant of motions for summary judgment by both the City of Champaign and the defendants and the security guard defendants. The nature of the case is essentially the false arrest of Deborah Williams and her 15-year-old son, Rashad, without probable cause, the excessive force used by the City of Champaign officers in arresting and detaining Deborah, Herman, and Rashad, the intentional infliction of emotional distress and refusal to call for medical attention for Deborah Williams, and as to the security guards, their false arrest and the negligent training by MIDAT services of the security guards.
Ms. Wyman, how much investigation do you believe officers must conduct once they have had, once they've received a dispatch with a license plate on it? And in other words, what else should they have done before pulling over the van? They've got the license plate.
They've got a license plate from someone who was not an eyewitness nor a victim.
But how did they know that?
They
got the dispatch.
They received, you're right, they received the dispatch. The officers didn't even ask any questions about when this occurred. There's no evidence in the record that the incident had occurred, no evidence regarding the proximity and location.
Chuck Carter, according to the evidence, it would seem, was told over the radio that a robbery had just occurred. So what other information do you believe he needed before calling in the report? I mean, you've not suggested anywhere, I don't believe, that he altered the facts or that he otherwise misrepresented what he heard. And yet, in your brief, you state repeatedly that he had no basis to report a robbery. And, I'm not getting it.
The children who were deposed, both of them stated they never told Chuck Carter that, or either the security guards, that they had been robbed. They never used
it. But wait a minute. It was the father who characterized the series of events as more like a robbery than a panhandling. But I want you to actually go back to Judge Rogner's first question. Here is a police officer. He's driving down the street in his squad car. He gets a dispatch from the dispatching service that says there's been a robbery. Here's the license plate number we have. Please take action. I take it you think that before the officers take action, they're supposed to interrogate the dispatcher, send the dispatcher back to the source of the original information, maybe back to the mall, long discussions back in through the dispatcher before the police do anything. And I don't know where that's written down as a rule. It seems to me very unrealistic for a police officer who receives, in the ordinary course, a dispatch with this much information. That's why it's, you know, called an investigation as opposed to a prosecution.
Your Honor, we're not suggesting that there be some sort of long, drawn-out investigation prior to a stop.
And I don't know how the police officers here would have had any reason to think that this wasn't something that needed looking into. They look into it. It turns out that, you know, there's no problem. They let the people go. 42 minutes elapse, and it's all done. Very unpleasant, I'm sure, for the people who have to go through it. I don't doubt that for a second. But it's what did the police – I'm having trouble figuring out what the police officers did wrong here.
Your Honor, the officers – in the entire time of, not just prior to the stop, but during the entire time of the detention of Deborah and Rashad in locked squad cars, Rashad in handcuffs, failed to investigate, failed to ask any
what
questions.
What do you think they should have done? They actually have other people going to the mall. They have the boys brought over to the cars. Isn't that investigation? They're just holding them for the time being. I don't know what you think If you had been their supervisor, you know, what would you have told them to do that they didn't do?
I would have suggested, and I think that the officers should have inquired as to when did this occur, was there any force involved, was there any gun, because what I believe Scott or Chuck Carter had said was the guy grabbed this late 20s, early 30s, guy grabbed $5. Then even if the court finds there was probable cause to stop, it's clear that neither Deborah nor her son, 15-year-old son Rashad,
6'1", 15-year-old son,
right,
Rashad,
bore no likeness to the perpetrator.
But he did bear likeness. He was seen through the glass of a van. The boys obviously make a mistake. They think that the person they see in the van is the perpetrator. It obviously is not. It's Rashad. But they write down the license plate number of the vehicle that they think the person is in. But as this time ticks by, it's very hard for me to imagine how the additional investigation that you think should have been happening, in addition to what they did, which was to bring the boys over, have them look at Rashad and say, no, that's not the guy, and then they wrap things up and off everybody goes. How they could have done more than that is difficult for me to imagine.
Your Honor, even if the court finds that there was probable cause to stop these individuals in front of their house with the car, the van that was returnable, it's a residential neighborhood, it is dead ends into a field, they continue to hold Deborah in the locked squad car. We believe that the court's cases have shown that this is that you can still find excessive force even when you find that the officers had probable cause to stop. The excessive force is clear in this case, that there were threats against each of the plaintiffs, each of the Williamses, to shoot them, to stop or I'll shoot you. The threat of deadly force. Even after they've searched Rashad Williams, they still put him in handcuffs, still put him in a separate locked vehicle. They put Deborah in a separate locked vehicle, even though she's complaining about not being able to breathe. I believe it's her cousin who is standing there near the street, repeatedly asks the officers to call for an ambulance, which they repeatedly refuse to do. And then an issue that I believe the City of Champaign never answers in their brief is that how it is reasonable for the officers, after the show-up, where the kids clearly say, no, this Rashad and his cousin were not the perpetrators, to return Rashad to the squad car, still in handcuffs, and question him about people and issues completely unrelated.
Well, there you have to deal with this court's decision and bank decision in Childs and ask the question. The magistrate judge decides that the additional detention time, the marginal additional time, is negligible because they were filling out some juvenile contact form anyway. And if that's the case, then the police, as Childs says, are allowed to talk to people.
I understand.
Talking isn't a detention.
I understand that the Childs decision, I don't believe that it is factually similar to this case, because it wasn't just, there's disputed issues of material fact, because the cops say, yes, it was to complete this juvenile detention card. What Rashad has testified to, or stated under oath in depositions, is that they were asking him about issues that were completely unrelated.
Yes, I know, I understand. I don't think that's at all inconsistent. One person's filling out this juvenile contact card, and the other people are talking to him about other topics, and we all agree. We assume that this is other topics that are being discussed, nothing to do with this stop. But Child says police can talk to you.
I understand that, Your Honor.
What's a juvenile contact card?
It's essentially, and I think there was one in the record but not attached to the briefs, you fill out the kid's name, their address, their phone number, and maybe whether they've ever been arrested before. But it's essentially...
This is just done routinely whenever the police encounter a kid?
I believe that's true, Your Honor, and I don't know how long, I don't recall offhand if it was in the record as to how long those records
are... You're not questioning the propriety of that.
Not at this time, Your Honor. But what is clear is that the time to fill out a juvenile detention card is at most a couple minutes. Rashawn, the 15-year-old, was held in handcuffs after he was had been threatened with deadly force, was held in handcuffs for at least 15 minutes then.
The problem I have with your threat of deadly force and keeping Mrs. Williams in the car, even though she was complaining about having trouble breathing, is what kind of code could you draft for police officers to guide them in situations like this? Because they have to worry about their personal safety, and they have to worry about phonies, you know, complaining, oh, I can't breathe, and so on. So what are they supposed to do? I don't know what administrable standard your position suggests.
Your Honor, in answer to that question, Deborah Williams was clearly not one of the perpetrators, doesn't resemble a black male, older 20s, early 30s. She was stopped right in front of her home in a residential neighborhood on a dead-end street. There was no threat to the officer's safety. They had they could tell of that. They could have allowed her to wait outside the
car. Relevance of stopping in front of her home. I mean, if she's part of a criminal gang or something, then her home could be a dangerous place for the police. I don't understand that.
Your Honor, I believe it's in the record that there's no criminal history of this woman, and that the
of course they not. But the point
that,
is, they've. I mean, I think they have the license plate, which is kind of hard to get around. You know, the license plate. They don't know what they're encountering. They don't know what they're dealing with. So they err on the side of protecting their own safety, and as I say, I don't know what you can. You don't want to put anybody on a kind of razor's edge, where if he's too cautious, he's violated their rights. If he's not cautious enough, he's jeopardized his safety and that of other people around him.
I understand your concern, Your Honor, but I think it's clear from Officer Liebach, the first officer on the scene, who never even pulled out his gun. I think it's clear from his demonstration that there was no threat.
I had a terrible problem trying to understand why it makes any difference whatsoever if the first officer on the scene doesn't pull out his gun, but the second one does. Different people see different things as they enter into a situation.
Your Honor, but I think it demonstrates the first officer who is... by being the first is alone, is the one who would be most at danger. And if he doesn't feel that he's at danger, then by having more officers on the scene, I don't think that...
But you're arguing for a subjective test, essentially, and I don't think that's what the law calls for. It's an objective assessment of these circumstances. So even if the first officer happens to be really macho or whatever, for some reason doesn't perceive himself to be in danger, the police... objectively might feel that a show of force is necessary, not doing anything, nobody gets killed, guns aren't discharged, and it's, you know, creating rules of law for these situations where the police have in fact made a mistake. You know, we all know with hindsight that it was the wrong car to stop. Whoever was coercing the boys into giving them money is out there, you know, and not the person here, is difficult because you don't want to create impossible rules for the police, and yet you, of course, want them to exercise caution so that innocent people aren't harassed.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that it's clear that even if there was probable cause to stop these, to stop the Williamses, that there was, that given the totality of the circumstances, especially the lack of proximity in location, I believe the lack of proximity, not just in the reporting, but in there was no evidence as to, I believe, the time of this panhandling incident. The totality of the circumstances did not merit the excessive force. One final issue, which was with regard to the security officers, clearly were not trained. They've admitted in
Is there a private right of action under the Illinois statute that you are relying on? The lock, the everything, you know, locksmith, private security guards.
The statute, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't have that answer. I could supplement that. I apologize.
Because that's critical to your point. I mean, the district judge rejects it on the no injury argument. They argue no causation. But if Illinois doesn't recognize a private right of action under that statute, either through some sort of negligence per se theory or otherwise, then you can't do anything with it anyway.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I apologize, I don't have an answer to that. I could supplement that. Regardless, the security guards made a false, we believe are liable under false arrest for falsely making these claims, including I got the 28 off the vehicle when in fact he had not. Had the security guards made the proper investigation as they're required to do, this false arrest either would not have occurred, or the threats of deadly force would not have occurred, and we believe that they're liable as well for that.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wyman. Ms. Norris.
May it please the court, counsel. It's evident by the record that the officers had reasonable suspicion and probable cause to stop the Williams van. We're talking about they get dispatched that it was a robbery call. It had just occurred. This time entry stamp that is not disputed by the Williamses is that the dispatch goes out at 5:42. And Deborah Williams' testimony, she said she left the mall at 5:15. So we're not talking a huge gap of time. This is approximately 31 minutes, if that.
What about the period during which Rashad was being questioned after the victim had exonerated him? So I understand they have to fill out this juvenile contact form, but I was unclear from your brief. What were they questioning him about for 15 minutes?
It's Rashad Williams' testimony that they were questioning him about, I believe, the location of his cousin.
What's that about?
I don't know, Your Honor, and it's our testimony.
They're interested in his cousin? But they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be questioning him about his cousin while he's in handcuffs after they've decided that he has nothing to do with the crime, should it? I mean, what's that about?
Well, first, I don't believe the investigation was completely over after the show-up in the sense
that... Well, I mean, did they think the cousin was somehow the perpetrator of the crime? Is that the idea?
I have no idea.
Have the officers ever advanced any justification for detaining Rashad after the show-up?
To complete the juvenile contact card, which is a 8x5 to...
But why do you have to do that in handcuffs? I mean, you know, I understand it was January, it's champagne, maybe they have some theory that leaving him in the car is more comfortable or whatever, but handcuffs are, you know, a clear signal that there's something wrong with you, right? You know, that you might do something violent or whatever, and he's been exonerated.
As the person that was not in the mall, as the perpetrator, but we have in our laws the right to have an accessory or a conspiracy, and I believe the investigation still may have been going on at that point, because after Rashad was placed back into the...
I understand if the police officers said, you know, we're satisfied that he's not the perpetrator, but we think he might be an accomplice. So we were questioning him to, you know, complete our investigation, but... As I say, I couldn't see in the briefs what they were asking about. Now you say they're asking about his cousin, but is that anything to do with this crime, or they have some interest in his cousin for some unrelated reason?
I thought the record was pretty clear it was unrelated. Things like, I guess Rashad testifies, his tattoos, his birth date, and the whereabouts of Jessica Brown, the cousin who was missing. But I didn't think there was any allegation that this had the slightest thing to do with what had just gone on in the mall.
The defendant officers all deny that they even questioned him. There's one officer that is not a defendant in this case.
No, but don't we have to accept his, for present purposes, don't we have to accept his testimony as truthful as to what they asked him about?
Yes, but the Williams have not presented any evidence that the time it took for the officer to complete the card, and if the question was going on as Rashad testified, it took any longer than necessary for Officer Beck to...
Well, I don't understand. To fill out the form, they have to ask him questions, right?
and they write out a disposition, like what happened. There was a negative show up. The juvenile contact card is in the record, and I believe it's the second
page. So your notion is they ask him a few questions that they need to fill out the form. Then while one of the police officers is busy completing the form, the other takes the opportunity of asking him questions about unrelated matters. Is that your theory?
And they don't bother to take the handcuffs off while this is all happening.
Reading through Rashad's testimony, he said that after the show-up, he was placed back into the squad car. Officer Beck went to ask his superior officers what they were going to do, what was going to happen. And then that's when he got back in the car and completed the juvenile contact card. I don't know, that it's not in evidence how long it took for Officer Beck to talk to his supervisors to figure out what they were going to do next. So I can't, you know, I don't know if sitting him in the car in the handcuffs was just waiting to see what was going to happen
next.
Is
there a rule of any sort that any time they're questioning possible suspects in a squad car that the individual is to be handcuffed?
I don't know specifically, but I know that it is done. I mean, I don't know of any law or policy that's the case. I do know in general that sometimes a perpetrator or suspect in the back of the car could move around and kick the window out and do other things of that nature. So I believe it's just for general safety purposes that they remain handcuffed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Norris. Mr. Austin?
Good morning. May it please the court. The trial court, in its grant of the motion for summary judgment, where the MIDAT defendants are concerned, relied upon its decision with regard to the city of Champaign, finding that since there was no false imprisonment or arrest on the part of the city, there could be no false imprisonment or arrest on the part of the security guards.
But surely that's wrong, because if the security guards had maliciously passed along false information to the dispatcher, but the dispatcher in good faith thinks that it's correct and relays it to the police officers and they pick it up, we wouldn't find liability on the part of the police officers who are entitled to rely on information passed along in the normal course. And yet, getting back to the sort of tainted source, we might be able to find liability on the part of the guards. I'm not saying that's what happened, but I'm just saying logically these two things strike me as separate.
I don't disagree with you. I think if you did have some malicious conduct, that may give rise to an entirely separate cause of action. But that wasn't what was alleged here. What was alleged against the security defendants were exactly the same allegations in this respect as alleged against the city.
So I'm not sure that's right. I think what's alleged against the security guards, among other things, is negligent or maybe grossly negligent behavior, and because they haven't been trained properly, they all say, oh no, nobody ever gave me any training. They don't even know how to conduct a proper investigation, and so in my own mind that translates into some form of negligent act when they make the report to the dispatcher. So I don't think that's the same problem that we have with the police officers.
Well, and I was referring to there are, of course, two separate matters. There's the question of whether there's some independent negligent basis aside from the false arrest and false imprisonment. I was addressing that. I think you're correct that you could come up with a cause of action, but the trial court's finding was that one of the necessary elements of finding a case of negligence would be showing injury, and that the injury which the plaintiffs were relying on this case did not occur.
But I don't see that, because it seems to me if the private security guards had properly conducted their investigation to begin with, then they would have realized, this is the hypothesis anyway, that the Rashad 8 car was not the car to go after, and these people would not have had the indignity of having guns pulled at them and being shoved in handcuffs into police cars and all the rest of it. In other words, you sort of nipped this in the bud. And that's, of course, not what happened. So I'm afraid the district court pushed these together a little too closely.
Well, I think what the court here has noted on the part of the police officers, how do you hold them to such a high standard in such a compressed period of time?
Let's go back to the security guards, your
clients.
Right,
that's where I'm going, which is to say that their part in this is even more emergent than that of the...
What is Illinois law? Can you sue a person for negligence for having carelessly reported a crime?
No.
No, okay. So what would be the cause of action under Illinois law? Are security guards in a different legal category from ordinary citizens who complain about a crime?
The plaintiffs have tried to say that in stating that under the Locksmith Act.
So what's the law? What's the law of Illinois? It should be a simple question.
Okay. Well, the law of Illinois is that there has to be, for a person who is reporting information that leads to the arrest of someone, for them to be liable for false imprisonment or arrest, there has to have been some act that tends toward directing or procuring the arrest, that the mere recitation of information to the police is not sufficient to give rise to a cause of action.
So let me ask you whether there's a private right of action.
Yeah. Sure, it's awfully muddy. What's the difference between reporting information and tending to procure an arrest? What's that about?
I'm not sure in the court's minds what it's been about, but essentially their rationale is to say that a private citizen doesn't get in trouble.
Come on now.
Well, you're not.
This issue must have arisen before, right? So what is the law, concretely? What do private security guards have to do in order to become liable for an arrest?
I don't think there's a separate law that pertains here with respect to private security guards. I think we're just talking about citizens in general.
If there's no separate rules for guards. Okay.
A private person is not liable for reporting information to the police that leads to a false arrest, even if that information is incorrect.
Yes, of course. Now the question is, what is this additional tending to procure or something that would make the person liable? What would be an example? What would be a case?
If the person apparently has some kind of vendetta and says to the police,
well,
I want you to arrest this
malicious.
Man, I'll
does
go
it have
with you,
to be
I'll
malicious?
Help you.
Does it have to be malicious?
No.
All right. So what is the example of the non-malicious complaint about a crime which leads to an arrest and makes the complainer liable?
Where they go with the police and they participate in pointing the person out or asking them to arrest the person. According to the law.
Why would it make a difference whether they complain about someone or they point to someone? I mean, what if you go up to a policeman and say, this person threatened me, or sorry, you know, panhandled or something, and they're wrong, but they're not malicious, they're careless, they're wrong. You know, people get frightened and make stupid judgments. So what difference should it make So why would a person be liable in that case?
Judge, I don't know, but that's not our case. I mean,
that's a really bad answer. I don't want to ever hear that answer. That's a very bad answer. I know it's not the case. Why would I be asking you this question? Would I be asking you under the mistaken impression that this is that case?
No, sir, I understand.
Wouldn't it make me really stupid to be asking that?
No, I'm sorry.
All right, so now I'm asking you, what is the legal situation in Illinois in that case? Right? I've pointed someone out. I say, that person threatened me. Now, does that mean if I made a careless mistake, I'm liable?
I believe under the law it could.
That doesn't make any sense. What difference could it make whether I point out the person, or I report the person. I call up the police. Instead, I see a police car and I say to the policeman, look, that person threatened me, and I'm wrong. But I'm not malicious, I'm just careless. Why should that case be treated differently from one in which you call up a police?
Well, as I understand it, you're dealing with a case where there's sort of a once-removed connection between the act of the imprisonment and the person who sets things in motion to do it. So at what point do you step over and become an active participant in making that false arrest or imprisonment happen? And I think that's the distinction.
Of course, the risk of error is greater when you're reporting something, you know, could be second or third hand, than when you actually think you saw it. You think you saw a crime committed, but you were wrong. Why would that be treated more harshly?
because the person is participating directly in the false arrest and false imprisonment.
I can't believe the law is that stupid.
How should we factor in the fact that the Carters never received the statutorily required training on the definitions of offenses in the Illinois Criminal Code?
Well, the court had asked earlier whether that gives rise to a private cause of action. I don't believe there's anything in the statute that does say that a private citizen has a cause of action under that statute, first of all. But secondly, if it does give rise, if the court were to find that it did, all that does is establish a grounds for saying there's a duty in negligence. But you still have to talk about foreseeability, proximate cause. And in a case such as this, where all they did was accurately, very accurately report what they were told by the complaining witnesses.
Right. But in other words, even though what you're saying is that even though we in here in Illinois have a statute that says these people who carry guns and are there for the protection of the citizenry, that it's quite all right not to provide them with the training that is provided for by the Illinois statute, that they are just excused.
Well, there would be administrative steps which may be taken against them for failing to comply with those requirements, but it doesn't mean a private citizen can come in and bring a suit.
So you're saying the company that hires them could be pursued by the Illinois Attorney General or some such thing? Is there any enforcement mechanism in the Illinois Detective Private Alarm, Private Security, and Locksmith Act?
I don't know.
Okay.
Doesn't seem right, does it?
Not if there isn't an administrative requirement, but in our case, where there's no private right of action, and you can't show that the failure to train them led to anything happening in this case, then there's not a connection. There's no harm that's caused by the failure to provide that training.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Austin. Ms. Ryman, how much time does she have? No time? Well, you can have a minute. Look, let me ask you about this security guard business. You don't have a very clear statement of Illinois law either. Surely it cannot be the law that just a negligent complaint about a crime is actionable. Otherwise, that's the end of citizen complaints, right?
Your Honor, I think there's a difference between a citizen complaint and someone like a security guard who is required to have certain training and is licensed. I think.
Well, what is the legal basis for that distinction?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I can answer that question. But
so there's no case you know of that says so, and there's no statute you know of that says that there is a heightened standard for private security guards. I don't see it,
right,
frankly, in this statute that we're talking about right now. It doesn't address this.
I'm not aware of one. I know that in Mr. Austin's brief, he references this Dunn-Rue or the one case that is referenced, and that was with a private citizen making a false claim. I think it's similar to, and I think we maybe have even addressed this in our brief, if I allege that Joe Smith raped me, and he never even raped me, there's no evidence, but he gets arrested and investigated, shouldn't I have some responsibility and have some cause? Shouldn't there be some cause of action for the false
allegations? Not necessarily. It depends. Of course, if it's deliberate falsification, of course, then clearly there's a remedy of false imprisonment, which is an intentional tort, and abusive process, malicious prosecution. But they all involve deliberate wrongdoing, whereas just a careless mistake. I mean, suppose you're raped, and you think you know who did it, and you're wrong. You're careless. You should have known better. But it was an innocent mistake, although a careless mistake. Well, I don't think there's a cause of action. I mean, for obvious reasons, right? No one is going to, I mean, maybe the victims will complain, but there'll be great reluctance to complain about criminal activity if it exposes you to liability.
Your Honor, I think there should be a distinction between an individual as opposed to someone who is required under statutes to be trained.
I could imagine that, but I could imagine that as a distinction to draw. But I don't see any basis in the law for that, in existing law. And we're reluctant to. Now, you could have argued, well, every state, there's no case in Illinois, but every other state or 20 other states, you know, have this distinction. But you didn't argue that.
Your Honor, you're correct. I did not. I would request that if the court would like, I could try to supplement the record.
It's a little late for that. And what did you present to the district court on this?
The same information, Your Honor, that we've provided in this brief. If I may answer a couple questions that Justice Rovner asked with regard to the handcuffs and the safety issue, it should be noted that Deborah, while she was in the car, was never handcuffed. And so it would not have been appropriate, I think as Ms. Norris had suggested, that there's a safety issue when Rashad was placed back in the squad car, still in handcuffs, after the negative show-up. I don't think there's any argument as to safety. There's nothing in the record that suggests that Rashad's cousin, who they were asking Rashad about on completely unrelated issues, was any perpetrator or in any way.
I suppose the police might worry that he'd be furious at them. As he was entitled to be, right?
Your Honor, I think that perhaps with that suggestion.
He's tall, right? So maybe they're worried.
He was already searched. We think this case, there are enough material.
In case of people, you know, kicking out the windows of police cars.
Your Honor, I think that then the jury should be allowed.
A very understandable impulse in his situation.
We think that the jury should be allowed to hear this case, and this case should be reversed from the summary judgment so that a jury can make a determination on the issues of material fact.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Wyman and Ms. Norris and Mr. Austin.